He hired about a dozen cowboys, mostly Mexican and Havasupai, to drive the cattle to the ranch and brand them before sending them out to the range. Cowboying was rough, and so were those kids. Misfits, most of them. Runaways and boys who'd been whipped too hard. For these young fellas, it was a question of joining the roundup or joining a circus. Not a lot of other options out there for them. And they took life day by day. The one thing they knew how to do better than anything else was stick a horse, and they took great pride in that. When the cowboys arrived, the first thing they did was head out into open country and round up a herd of range horses, which they proceeded to break, after a fashion, in the palisaded corral. The horses bucked and fishtailed like rodeo broncs, but those hard-ass boys would just as soon bust every bone in their bodies before calling it quits. They weren't much more than half-broke horses themselves. I stood there watching them with Rosemary. "I feel bad for the horses," she said. "They just want to be free." "In this life," I said, "hardly anyone gets to do what they want to do." Once the cowboys each had a string of horses, they started bringing in the cattle and branding them. They were all living in the bunkhouse, and I had my hands full cooking for everyone, in addition to helping out with the branding. The cowboys got steak and eggs for breakfast and steak and beans for dinner, with as much salt and roof water as they wanted. Anyone who asked for one could have a raw onion, as good as an orange for staving off scurvy. Most of the boys peeled those onions and ate them like apples. I didn't particularly trust them around Rosemary, who wasn't allowed to go near the bunkhouse, where there was nonstop cussing, drinking, brawling, card play, and knife play. And that was when I got in the habit of sleeping with her in the bedroom of the ranch house, while Big Jim and Little Jim slept in the main room. Rosemary was also a little like a half-broke horse. She was happiest running around out of doors without a stitch of clothing if I'd let her. She climbed the cedar trees, splashed in the horse trough, peed in the yard, swung from the vines, and jumped from the barn rafters into the hay bales, yelling at my mite to stand clear. She loved spending the day on horseback, holding on behind her father. The saddles were too heavy for her to lift, so she rode her little mule Jenny bareback, mounting her by grabbing mane and toe-walking up the animal's leg. Jim once told Rosemary that she was so tough, any critter that took a bite of her would spit it out, and she just loved that. Rosemary was never afraid of coyotes or wolves, and she hated to see any animal caged, tied up, or penned in. She even thought that the chicken should be freed from the coop, that the risk of being eaten by a coyote was a price worth paying for freedom. And besides, she said, the coyotes needed food too. That was why I always blamed Rosemary for what happened to Bossy the cow. The Ponds were so thrilled with Jim's work on the ranch that they sent us a pure-blooded Guernsey. Bossy was dun-colored, big and beautiful, and she gave us 2 gallons a day of rich milk with good cream. She was such a good milk cow that I plan to breed her in the fall, sell the calf in the spring, and sock away the proceeds. I had already begun to think about saving for the day when we could afford a ranch of our own. But one day, someone left Bossy's stall unlatched, and she broke into the granary, where she devoured almost an entire bag of feed. When old Jake came upon her, she had bloated and was leaning against the barn wall, her stomach swollen while she groaned in pain. Jim and old Jake did everything they could. To get her to throw up, they made a mixture of the worst stuff they could think of. Tobacco and milk of magnesia and whiskey and soapy water. They put it in a whiskey bottle and tried to pour it down her throat, but Bossy wouldn't swallow, and it dribbled out the sides of her mouth. So then old Jake held her jaws apart while Jim stuck the bottle so far inside her gullet that his arm disappeared up to his elbow. He poured the concoction directly into her stomach, and she did throw up a little, but she was so far gone by then that it made no difference. Her knees buckled, and she collapsed slowly to the ground. In desperation, Jim punctured her gut with his pocket knife to let the gas out. But that didn't work either. And in another hour, our big, beautiful Guernsey was gone, lying glass-eyed and heavy on the barn floor. I was furious, heartbroken about the death of Bossy, but beside myself about the loss of what I'd hoped we'd earn from calving season. I was sure that it was Rosemary, with her misguided notions about animals and freedom, who had let Bossy out. The girl had been too horrified to watch Jim and Old Jake ministering to the cow, and I found her on the long porch, sobbing about Bossy's end. I felt like smacking her good, but she'd insisted she hadn't let the cow out, that it was little Jim who'd done it. And since I didn't have any proof one way or another, I had to let the matter go. "Just you remember," I said, "that this is what could happen when an animal gets freedom. Animals act like they hate to be penned up, but the fact is, they don't know what to do with freedom, and a lot of times it kills them." Shortly after the herd arrived, Jim set out to repair all the fencing on the ranch. The job took a month. He brought Rosemary along with him in the pickup, and they were gone for days at a time, sleeping in the bed of the truck, cooking over campfires, and returning only for resupplies of food and wire. Rosemary adored her father, and he was completely unfazed by her wild streak. They were happy to spend hours in each other's company, Rosemary talking nonstop, and Jim barely saying a word, just nodding and smiling with an occasional, "That's so," or "Sounds good," as he dug holes, trimmed posts, and tightened wire. "Doesn't that kid ever shut up?" Old Jake once asked. "She's got a lot to say," Jim told him. While they were gone, I settled into life on the ranch. There was always more to do on any given day than you could get done, and I quickly established a few rules for myself. One was to dispense with any unnecessary cleaning. No maid's work. Arizona was a dusty place, but a little dirt never killed anyone. That bit about cleanliness being next to godliness was a lot of balderdash as far as I was concerned. In fact, I considered it downright insulting. Anyone who worked the land got dirty, and in Chicago I'd seen my share of less than godly people living in squeaky clean mansions. So I gave the house a good going over only once every few months, working myself into a frenzy and blazing through all the scrubbing and dusting in a single day. As for the clothes, I flatly refused to wash them. I made sure we all bought loose-fitting clothes that let us do squats and windmill our arms. None of that tight, buttoned-up stuff like my mother favored. We wore our shirts till they got dirty. Then we put them on backward and wore them until that side got dirty. Then we wore them inside out. Then inside out backward. We're getting four times more wear out of each shirt than persnickety folks did. When the shirts reached the point where Jim was joking about them scaring the cattle, I take the whole pile into Seligman and pay by the pound to have them all steam cleaned. Levi's we didn't wash at all. They shrank too much, and it weakened the threads. So we wore them and wore them until they were shiny with mud, manure, tallow, cattle slobber, bacon fat, axle grease, and hoof oil. And then we wore them some more. Eventually, the Levi's reached a point of grime saturation where they couldn't get any dirtier, where they had the feel of oil skin, and they became not just waterproof, but briarproof. And that was when you knew that you had really broken them in. When Levi's reached that degree of conditioning, they were sort of like smoke-cured ham or aged bourbon, and you couldn't pay a cowboy to let you wash his. I kept the cooking basic as well. I didn't make dishes the way fancy Eastern housewives did, souffles and sauces and garnished this and stuffed that. I made food. Beans were my specialty. I always had a pot of them on the stove, and that usually lasted 2 to 5 days, depending on how many cowboys we had around. My recipe was fairly simple. Boil beans, salt to taste. What I liked most about beans was that as long as you added water from time to time, you couldn't overcook them. When we weren't having beans, we had steak. My recipe for steak was also fairly simple. Fry on both sides, salt to taste. With steak came potatoes. Boil unpeeled, salt to taste. For dessert, we'd have canned peaches packed in tasty syrup. I like to say that what my cooking lacked in variety, it made up for in consistency. "No surprises," I'd tell the cowboys, "but no disappointments either." Once, when some milk had spoiled and I was feeling ambitious, I made cottage cheese the way my mother made it when I was growing up. I boiled the clabbered milk and cut up the curds with a knife. Then I wrapped it in a burlap sugar sack and hung it overnight to let the whey drain out. The next day I chopped it again salted it, and passed it out at supper. The family loved it so much they woofed it down in under a minute. I couldn't believe I'd worked so long on something that was gone so quickly. "That was the biggest waste of time," I said. "I'll never make that mistake again." Rosemary was eyeing me. "Let that be a lesson to you," I told her. Jim never had it in him to raise his hand to his daughter, and when he and Rosemary returned from fixing fences, she was more rambunctious than ever. Even though Rosemary was still a little girl, I could see the beginnings of a fundamental difference of opinion between her and me. I felt there was a lot I needed to teach her. I wanted to give her an early grounding in the basics of arithmetic and reading, but even more important, I wanted to get across the idea that the world was a dangerous place, and life was unpredictable, and you had to be smart, focused, and determined to make it through. You had to be willing to work hard and persevere in the face of misfortune. A lot of people, even those born with brains and beauty, didn't have what it took to knuckle down and get things done. From the time she was 3, I drilled Rosemary on her numbers. If she asked for a glass of milk, I told her she could have it only if she spelled out milk. I tried to make her see that everything in life, from bossy to the cottage cheese, was a lesson, but it was up to her to figure out what she'd learned. Rosemary was a bright little kid in a lot of ways, but math and spelling confused her, and answering questions on cue bored her, as did the routine of daily chores. Jim told me to lighten up. She was just 4, but by 4, I'd been gathering eggs and taking care of my baby sister. I began to worry that Rosemary was unfocused, and if we didn't stamp it out early, it could become a permanent part of her character. "She'll outgrow it," Jim said, "and if she don't, that means it's her nature, not something we can change." "It's up to us to set her straight," I said. "I turned illiterate Mexican kids into readers. I can make my own daughter shape up." Rosemary was always getting caught up in dangerous situations, almost as if she was drawn to them. She was constantly falling into draws and out of trees. It was always the buckingest horse that caught her eye. She loved to catch snakes and scorpions, keeping them in a jar for a while. But then she'd grow worried they were lonely and missed their families, so she'd turn them loose. That first October on the ranch, we bought a pumpkin in Seligman and carved it into a jack-o'-lantern to celebrate Halloween. Rosemary had dressed for Halloween in a tattered old silk dress she'd found in a trunk in the storage barn. And she held it over the jack-o'-lantern, fascinated by the patterns that the flame made through the thin fabric. Jim and I weren't paying much attention when she lowered the dress too close to the candle and it caught fire, the dry silk bursting into flames. Rosemary was screaming while Jim grabbed his horsehide duster and wrapped it around her to smother the flames. It was all over in an instant. We carried her into the bedroom, and Jim quietly talked her down from hysteria while I cut off the remains of the silk dress. Rosemary had a wide burn across her stomach, though it wasn't too deep. The nearest hospital was over 2 hours away, and besides, I didn't care to splurge on a doctor. So I lathered her burn in Vaseline, which cured everything from boils to rashes, and bandaged her up. When I was finished, I looked down at her and shook my head. "Are you mad at me, Mommy?" Rosemary asked. "Not as mad as I should be," I said. I just didn't believe in mollycoddling kids when they hurt themselves. Fussing over her wasn't going to help her realize the mistake she'd made. "You're the most accident-prone little girl I've ever known. And I hope at least you've learned what happens when you play with fire." Still, she'd been pretty brave about it all. She was always a brave little kid. You had to hand it to her. And I softened up. "Same thing happened to my brother Buster when he was small, and to my grandfather," I said. "So I guess it runs in the family." That first winter, Jim and I paid $50 for a marvelous long-range radio from Montgomery Ward. It had a big wire antenna that a couple of cowboys helped us rig up, stringing it between 2 of the tall cedars outside the house. "Brings the 20th century to Yavapai County," I told Jim. Since we had no electricity, we ran the radio off 2 massive batteries that cost another $50 and weighed about 10 pounds apiece. When the batteries were fresh, we could get stations all the way from Europe, with announcers jabbering away in French and German. Adolf Hitler had taken over in Germany, and the Civil War was brewing in Spain, but we weren't particularly interested in European affairs. The reason we shelled out so much money was to get the weather report, which was much more important to us than what the Krauts were up to. Every morning we got up before dawn, and Jim turned the radio on low, crouching down next to it to listen to the weather report from a station in California. The fronts that came our way usually started there, though sometimes we were hit by winter storms that traveled all the way down from Canada. With water so scarce and severe storms so dangerous, drowning or freezing cattle, flattening barns, washing away entire families, the lightning electrocuting horses with steel shoes, we lived and died by those forecasts. You could say we were true aficionados of the weather. We'd follow a storm that started out in Los Angeles and moved east. The clouds usually ended up getting caught by the tip of the Rockies, where they dumped most of their moisture. But sometimes, that storm drifted south, making its way east through a passage above the Gulf of California. And that was when we got our big rains. Rosemary and little Jim loved the storms more than just about anything else. When the skies turned dark and the air grew heavy, I called them onto the porch, and we all watched as the storm, with its boiling clouds and cannonading thunder, its white claws of lightning and drifting sheets of black rain, rolled across the range. A distant storm sometimes seems small in the huge sweep of the plateau, darkening one patch of land while everything else remained bathed in sunlight. Sometimes the storm veered off and missed us altogether. But if it hit the yard, the excitement really began, the thunder and lightning splitting the sky, the water hammering on the tin roof and pouring off the sides, filling the cisterns and draws in the dams. To live in a place where water was so scarce made the rare moments like this, when the heavens poured forth an abundance of water, and the hard earth softened and turned lush and green, seemed magical, almost miraculous. The kids had an irresistible urge to get out and dance in the rain, and I always let them go, and sometimes join them myself, all of us prancing around, our arms upraised as the water beat down on our faces, plastering our hair and soaking our clothes. Afterwards, we all ran down to the draws that led to Big Jim the dam, and once the first rush of water had passed, I'd let the kids strip off their clothes and go swimming. They'd stay out there for hours, paddling around, pretending to be alligators or dolphins or hippopotamuses. They had a heck of a time playing in the rain puddles, too. When the water sank through the soil, and all that was left was mud, they'd keep playing, rolling around until everything but the whites of their eyes and their teeth was plastered with mud. Once the mud dried, which didn't take long, it sheared right off, leaving them pretty clean, and they got back into their clothes. Sometimes over supper, when Jim got home after a storm, the kids would describe their escapades in the water and mud, and Jim would recount his vast store of water lore and water history. Once the world was nothing but water, he explained, and you wouldn't think it to look at us, but human beings were mostly water. The miraculous thing about water, he said, was that it never came to an end. All the water on Earth had been here since the beginning of time. It had just moved around from rivers and lakes and oceans to clouds and rains and puddles, and then sunk through the soil to underground streams, to springs and wells, where it got drunk by people and animals and went back to rivers and lakes and oceans. The water you kids were playing in, he said, had probably been to Africa and the North Pole. Genghis Khan or St. Peter or even Jesus himself might have drunk it. Cleopatra might have bathed in it. Crazy Horse might have watered his pony with it. Sometimes water was liquid. Sometimes it was rock hard, ice. Sometimes it was soft, snow. Sometimes it was visible but weightless, clouds. And sometimes it was completely invisible, vapor, floating up into the sky like the souls of dead people. There was nothing like water in the world, Jim said. It made the desert bloom, but also turned rich bottomland into swamp. Without it would die, but it could also kill us. And that was why we loved it, even craved it, but also feared it. Never take water for granted, Jim said. Always cherish it. Always beware of it. The rains usually arrived in April, August, and December. But in our second year on the ranch, April came and went without rain. So did August, and so did December. and by the following year, we were in the midst of a serious drought. The range turned sandy and windblown, and the mudflats became dry and cracked. Every day, Jim listened grim-faced to the weather report, hoping in vain for a forecast of rain, and then would go down and check the water level of Big Jim. The days were beautiful with endless deep blue skies, but all that fine weather only gave us a desperate, helpless feeling as we stood there, watching the water level sink and sink until the bottom of Big Jim became visible. And then the water disappeared altogether, and there was nothing but mud. And then the mud dried out with cracks so big you could stick your arm into them. Early into the drought, Jim had sensed it coming. He'd grown up in the desert, so he knew that one came along every 10 or 15 years. And he had culled the herd deeply, selling off steers and heifers and keeping only the healthiest breeding cattle. Even so, once the drought was in full swing, we had to bring in water. Jim and I hitched up the Conestoga wagon to the pickup and hauled it into Pica, a stop 20 miles away on the Santa Fe Railroad where they were shipping in water. We loaded old fuel drums with as much water as the Conestoga could hold and hauled it, the wagon suspension groaning under all that weight, back to the ranch, where we drained it into Big Jim. We made that trip a couple of times a week. We darn near broke our backs loading those fuel drums, but we saved the herd, whereas many ranches around us went bust. The following August, the rains returned, and when they came back, they came with a vengeance, a terrific deluge the likes of which I'd never seen. We sat at our kitchen table, a long wooden thing, with patterned linoleum nailed to the top, listening to the rain drum on the roof. Unlike other storms, this one didn't peter out after an hour. Instead, it kept raining and raining, striking the tin roof so loud and incessant that it began to get on my nerves. After a while, Jim started worrying about Big Jim. If too much water flooded into the dam, he said, its walls might burst and would lose it all. The first time Jim went out to check the dam, he reported back that it was holding. But an hour later, with the rain still coming down in sheets, he checked it again and realized that if nothing was done, it would give. He had a plan, which was to go out in the middle of the storm and dig furrows in the draws and the wash approaching the dam to drain off the water before it reached Big Jim. To dig the furrows, he was going to harness Old Buck, our Percheron draft, to the plow. Jim had on his horsehide duster, waterlogged and dripping. I put on my canvas coat and we headed out into the rain, which was coming down so furiously that within moments it had worked its way past my turned-up collar, down my sleeve, and was soaking through my shoes. I felt it trickling all over me, and even before we got to the barn, I had reached the point where you give up trying to stay dry. The barn was dark from the storm, and we couldn't find the harness, which no one had used in years. Old Jake, who had sprained his good foot falling off a horse and was hobbling around worse than ever, started getting panicky at the idea of the dam giving out and washing away the cattle, but I told him to hush his mouth. We all knew what was at stake, and if we were going to save the ranch, we needed clear heads. What we could do, I said to Jim, was hitch the plow to the pickup. If he handled the plow, I could drive. Jim liked the idea. Old Jake was useless, so we left him to fret in the barn, but we brought the kids with us. The water out in the yard was more than ankle deep by then, the rain coming down so hard that the force of it practically knocked Rosemary to the ground. Jim scooped her up in his arms. I followed with little Jim, who was still a baby, grabbing a wooden carton so it would have something to keep him in, and we sloshed out to the Chevy. At the equipment shed, Jim jumped out and threw the plow, together with some ropes and chains, into the pickup bed. Once we reached the wash above the dam, we rigged up the plow to the Chevy's hitch, and I got behind the wheel, putting little Jim in the carton on the floor so he wouldn't slide around too much. I looked in the rearview mirror, but the rain was splattering so hard on the window that Jim was just a blur. I had Rosemary stand up on the seat and stick her head out the window and take directions from him. Jim was gesturing and shouting, but the rain was making such a racket that it was hard to figure out what he wanted. "Mama, I can't hear him," Rosemary said. "Do the best you can," I said. "That's all anyone can do." I needed the pickup to creep along at a walking pace, but the Chevy wasn't geared to go that slow, and it kept stalling and lurching, jerking the plow out of Jim's hands, and sending Rosemary tumbling off the seat and into Little Jim's box. Making matters worse, the earth around the dam was that godforsaken Malpie rock, and the tires would spin on it, then catch, and we'd pop forward. We knew we didn't have much time, and Jim and I were both cussing like sailors while Rosemary, her hair plastered, scrambling back onto the seat every time she was knocked off, did her best to read Jim's gestures and shouts and relay them to me. Finally, I figured out that by engaging the clutch, easing up on it ever so slightly, then re-engaging it, I could send the truck forward just a few inches at a time. And that was how we got the job done, digging four furrows off the sides of the wash that drained the rising water away from the dam. It was still raining furiously. Jim heaved the plow into the pickup bed and climbed in beside me. He was as wet as if he'd fallen into a horse trough. Water sloshed in his boots and dripped from his hat and sopping horsehide coat, pulling on the seat. "We did a good job, good as we could," he said. "If she breaks, she breaks." She didn't break. While our place was spared, not everyone fared as well. The rains washed away a few bridges and several miles of railroad track. Ranchers lost cattle and outbuildings. Seligman was flooded, several houses were swept off, and the rest had mudlines 5 feet high, which was so astounding that no one wanted to paint over them. For years afterwards, folks who'd lived through the storm pointed out those mudlines in a combination of disbelief and pride. "Water come clean up to there," they'd say, shaking their head. But a few hours after the rain stopped, the plateau turned bright green, and the next day, the ranch was covered with the most spectacular display of flowers I had ever seen. There were crimson Indian paintbrushes and orange California poppies, white Mariposa poppies with their magenta throats, goldenrod and blue lupine, and pink and purple sweet peas. It was like a rainbow you could touch and smell. All that water must have churned up seeds that had been buried for decades. Rosemary, who was ecstatic over it, spent days collecting flowers. "If we had this much water all the time," I told her, "we might have to break down and give this ranch some greenhorn name like Paradise Plateau." Chapter 6. Teacher Lady. The water we bought during the drought cost a fortune, but the Palms knew that ranching was a long-term proposition only for people with wallets fat enough to tough out the bad times and then make a killing in the good. They actually saw the drought and all the bankruptcies it was causing as a buying opportunity. And so did Jim. As much land as we had, he realized that if the ranch was going to make it through the next drought, we needed even more land. Land with its own water. He convinced the investors to buy the neighboring ranch called Hackberry. It had some hilly terrain with a year-round spring, and out of the flat range, there was a deep well with a windmill that pumped water up to the cattle troughs. Jim's plan was to move the herd back and forth between the two ranches, keeping the cattle in Hackberry during the winter and bringing them back to the high plateau around Big Jim in the summer. When the two ranches were combined, they totaled 180,000 acres. It was a big spread, one of the biggest in Arizona, and in good years, we could bring some 10,000 head of cattle to market. When the Palms saw those numbers, they were more than happy to pony up for Hackberry. The first time we rode out to Hackberry, I flat out fell in love with the place. It was down off the plateau, between the Peacocks and Wallapai Mountains, the range dotted by chaparral. Runoff from the mountains fed the plain, and there was also that spring in the granite foothills. The house, nestled in a hollow, was a former dance hall that had been taken apart, moved to the spot, and reassembled, with a swank linoleum floor and the walls painted with signs saying, "No rough stuff," and "Take the fight outside." The first time I saw the windmill, I took a drink of its well water, which came from deep beneath us and had been there for tens of thousands of years waiting for me to taste it. That well water tasted sweeter than the finest French liqueur. Some folks, when they struck it rich, liked to say they were in the money And that was how I felt. Rich. Only we were in the water. Our days of busting our humps, hauling fuel drums over dirt roads were gone for good. After the Palms bought Hackberry, one of the first things Jim did was drive all the way to Los Angeles in the Chevy and return with a truckload of half-inch lead pipe. It was a mile from the spring to the house, and we laid pipe the entire length, running strips of inner tube between the interconnecting pipe ends and tying it up with baling wire. It wasn't indoor plumbing, and it wasn't exactly pretty, but it brought a constant supply of spring water to our back door, spurting forth clear and fresh when you opened the spigot. Next to the spigot, we kept a metal cup, and few things were finer than coming back from a hot, dusty ride and filling that cup with cold, wet drink, then pouring what was left over your head. We moved the herd over to Hackberry in the fall and stayed there until spring. I always loved bright colors, and at Hackberry, I decided to really go to town. I painted each room a different color, pink, blue, and yellow, put Navajo rugs on the floors, and got some red velvet curtains for the windows, using several books of S&H green stamps that I'd saved over the years. Rosemary loved colors even more than I did. She was already showing some artistic talent, tossing off perfect little line drawings without once lifting the pencil from the paper. Both kids were crazy about Hackberry. Its green mountains, the lilacs, the birds of paradise, the tamarack trees around the chicken coop. There were several deep canyons running down out of the mountains, and after it rained, I'd rush with the kids up to the lip of one of them, and we'd watch and cheer as the flash floods came thundering down the dry creek beds, shaking the ground beneath us. Rosemary and Little Jim were also fascinated by the story of Hackberry's ghosts. Years earlier, a fire had broken out in the house when two children were inside. The mother rushed in and saved the boy, then returned to get her baby girl. But they both died in the flames, and the little boy standing outside could hear their anguished cries. A few months later, the boy was on his swing, and he started going higher and higher, pumping his legs, trying to get to heaven to be with his mother and sister. But he swung so high that he fell off and died as well. All three of them supposedly haunted the ranch, and Rosemary, instead of being frightened, couldn't stop looking for them. She'd wander around at night, calling out their names, and whenever she heard a sudden noise, a distant bobcat, a rustling in the tamarack trees, oil drums expanding with a bang in the heat, she'd get excited thinking maybe it was the ghosts. She was particularly intrigued by the little boy ghost, and she wanted to explain to him that since he was with his mother and sister, everything was, in fact, okay, and they were all free to go to heaven. Ever since moving to the ranch, Jim and I had talked on and off about buying it, or at least buying a place of our own one day. But we'd had our hands full getting the ranch up and running, and buying had seemed a distant dream. Now that I'd spent time at Hackberry, a beautiful spread with good water, I wanted it and was determined to turn my dream into a plan. We needed cash. We were never going to go into debt again, I swore. We were not going to lose this place the way we'd lost the house in Villain Station in Ash Fork. I worked up the figures and decided we might be able to swing it in 10 years if I started bringing in money, and we scrimped and saved, pinching every penny till old Abe Lincoln yelped. We'd always been frugal. Jim made the Palms a lot of money, but he made it a nickel at a time, reusing nails, saving old barbed wire, building fences with juniper saplings rather than milled posts. We never threw anything away. We saved bits of woods in case we needed shims. When our old shirts finally frayed to pieces, we cut off the buttons and put them in the button box. The shirts we either used as rags or gave to a seamstress in Seligman who turned them into patchwork quilts. But now I came up with additional ways to save money. We made the children chairs out of orange crates. Rosemary drew on used paper bags both sides and painted on old boards. We drank from coffee cans with wire tied around them for handles. Whenever possible, I drove behind trucks, so their slipstream pulled me along and I saved on gas. I also came up with all sorts of money-making schemes, some more successful than others. I sold encyclopedias door to door, but that didn't go over so well, seeing as how there were not a lot of bookish ranch hands in Yavapai County. I did a lot better visiting neighbors to solicit orders for Montgomery Ward, and I didn't even have to resort to tricks like throwing dirt on the floor, the way my crumb-bum first husband did. I also stayed up late writing short stories about cowboys and gunslingers for pulp magazines, using the nom de plume Legs Leroy, because I figured those pulp editors wouldn't buy Western tales from a lady. But I got no takers. I collected scrap metal in the Chevy and sold it by the pound. I also started playing poker with the hands, but Jim put a stop to that after I cleaned a couple of them out. "We don't pay them enough as it is," he said. "We can't go taking what little they get." On weekends, I drove down Highway 66 with the kids, sending them out to pick up bottles that people had thrown out their car windows. Rosemary would take one side of the road, little Jim the other, each of them dragging a burlap bag. The deposit was 2 cents for Coke bottles, 5 cents for cream bottles, 10 cents for milk bottles, and a quarter for gallon jugs. One day, we collected $30 worth of bottles. Sometimes other drivers would stop to see if we were okay. "You folks need any help there?" they'd call out. "We're just dandy," I'd say. "Got any empties?" Rosemary loved our scavenging expeditions. One day, all four of us were overpaying a call on our neighbors, the Hutters. After dinner, we were heading back to the Chevy parked near their barn, when Rosemary spotted a bottle in the fuel drum that they used to hold trash. She ran to fetch it. "Lily, this is getting a little out of hand," Jim said. "We're not so darned broke that we need to have our daughter digging around in someone's garbage for a 2 cent bottle." Rosemary held up the bottle. "It's not a 2 center, Dad," she said. "It's a 10 center. "Good girl," I said, and turned to Jim. 10 cents adds up, and anyway, I'm teaching them resourcefulness." By then, I was closing in on my 39th birthday, and there was still one thing I'd never done and had always wanted to do. One summer day, Jim and the kids and I had driven the flivver over to Mojave County to look at a breeding bull Jim was interested in buying when we passed a ranch with a small plane parked near the gate. A hand-painted sign in the windshield read, "Flying lessons, $5. "That's for me," I said. I had Jim pull into the driveway, and we stopped to look at the plane. It was a 2-seater, one behind the other, with an open cockpit, a faded green paint job, rust rings around the rivets, and a rudder that creaked in the wind. I remember the first time I'd seen an airplane, when I was riding Patches through the desert back from Red Lake. I loved Patches, but that had been one long, rump-numbing journey. On an airplane, it wouldn't have been much more than a little hop. A fellow came out of a shack behind the plane and sauntered up to the flivver. He had a wind-burned face, a cigarette dangling from his mouth, and a pair of aviator goggles pushed up on his forehead. He rested his elbow on Jim's open window and said, "Looking to learn her?" I leaned across the gearbox. "Not him," I said. "Me." "Whoa," Goggle said. "Ain't never taught a woman before." He looked at Jim. "Think the little lady's up to it?" "Don't you little lady me," I said. "I break horses. I brand steers. I run a ranch with a couple of dozen crazy cowboys on it, and I can beat them all in poker. I'll be damned if some nincompoop is going to stand there and tell me I don't have what it takes to fly that dinky heap of tin." Goggles stared at me for a moment. Then Jim patted him on the arm. "No one's ever won betting against her," Jim said. "That don't surprise me," Goggles said. He pulled out a fresh cigarette and lit it with the old one. "Ma'am, I like your spirit. Let's take her up." Goggles brought out a flight suit for me, along with a leather aviation helmet and a set of goggles. As I pulled them on, he walked me around the plane, checking the struts, pointing out the ailerons, explaining the basics such as lift and tailwind, and showing me how to operate the co-pilot's stick. But Goggles wasn't much for theory, and soon he was climbing aboard and having me climb in behind him. As I did, I realized that the fuselage wasn't made of metal after all, but canvas. That airplane was one right spindly contraption. Then we were taxiing down the driveway, bumping along, gathering speed. The bumping stopped, but at first I wasn't even aware that we were airborne. It was that smooth. Then I saw the ground falling away beneath us, and I knew I was flying. We circled around. The kids were running back and forth, waving like mad. And even Jim was enthusiastically flapping his hat. I leaned out and waved. The sky was a royal blue, and as we gained altitude, I saw the Arizona Range rolling away in all directions, the Moleon Rim to the east, and in the distant west, beyond a serpentine river, the Rockies, with some thin high clouds hovering above them. Route 66 threaded its way like a ribbon through the desert, a few tiny cars moving along it. Living in Arizona, I was used to long views. But still, the sight of the earth spread out far below me made me feel huge and aloof, like I was beholding the entire world. Seeing it all for the first time, the way I figured angels did. Goggles operated the controls for most of the lesson. But by keeping my hand on the stick, I was able to follow the way he banked, climbed, and dived. Toward the end, he let me take over, and after a few heart-stopping jerks, I was able to put the plane into a long, steady turn that brought us right into the sun. Afterward, I thanked Goggles, paid him, and told him that he'd be seeing me again. As we walked back to the car, Rosemary said, "I thought we were supposed to save money." "Even more important than saving money is making it," I said. "And sometimes, to make money, you have to spend it." I told her that if I got a pilot's license, I could bring in cash, dusting crops and delivering mail and flying rich people around. "This lesson was an investment," I said, "in me." Working as a freelance bush pilot struck me as one glorious way of earning a living, but I knew it would take a while to get my pilot license, and we needed money now. I finally decided that the smartest way for me to bring in the bucks was to put my most marketable skill, teaching, back into use. I wrote Grady Gamage, who had helped me get the job in Red Lake, to ask if he knew of any opportunities. He replied that there was a town called Main Street with an opening. It was up in the Arizona Strip, and I'd be welcome there, he said, because Main Street was so remote and, quite frankly, so peculiar that no teacher with a college degree wanted the job. "Truth be known," he went on, "the people in the area were almost all Mormon polygamists who'd moved all the way out there to escape government harassment." Neither remoteness nor peculiarity troubled me. And as for Mormons, I'd married one, so I figured I could handle a few polygamists. I wrote back telling Grady Gamage to sign me up. What made most sense was to take Rosemary and little Jim with me. So one day in the late summer, we packed the Flivver, which was still running but on its last legs, and headed for the Arizona Strip. Jim followed in the Chevy to help us get settled. The Arizona Strip was in the northwest corner of Mojave County, cut off from the rest of the state by the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River. To get there, we had to drive into Nevada, then Utah, then turn back south to Arizona. I wanted my children to see the awesomeness of modern technology, so we stopped off at the Boulder Dam, where four enormous turbines generated electricity that was sent all the way to California. It was Jim's idea to also visit one of the ruined cities of the Hohokams, an ancient and extinct tribe that had built elaborate four-story houses and a complex irrigation system. We stood there for a while, looking at those collapsed sandstone buildings and the troughs that had carried water directly to the Hohokam's houses. "What happened to the Hohokam's, Daddy?" Rosemary asked. "They thought they could civilize the desert," Jim said, "and it was their undoing. The only way to survive in the desert is to recognize that it's a desert." The Arizona Strip was desolate but beautiful country. There were grassland plateaus where distant mountains sparkled with mica, and sandstone hills and gullies that had been carved into wondrous shapes, hourglasses and spinning tops and teardrops, by wind and water. The sight of all that time-worn stone, shaped grain by grain over thousands and thousands of years, made it seem like the place had been created by a very patient God. The town of Main Street was so small that it didn't appear on most maps. In fact, the Main Street of Main Street was the only street, lined with a few ramshackle houses, one general store, and the school, which had a teacher each. It was nothing fancy, one tiny room with two box windows and a single bed that little Jim, Rosemary, and I would share. The water barrel outside the kitchen was swimming with pollywogs. "At least you know it's not poison," Jim said. "Just drink with your teeth closed." Many of the people in the area herded sheep, but the land had been overgrazed, and it was startling how threadbare the local folks were. None of them had cars. Instead, they drove wagons or, too poor to afford saddles, rode horses with just blankets on their backs. Some lived in chicken coops. The women wore bonnets, and the children came to school barefoot, and in overalls or dresses stitched from feed sacks. Their underwear, if they had any, was also made of feed sacks. Some Mormons were sewed into ceremonial undergarments during a special church ritual, and since the garments were supposed to protect them from harm, snide folks referred to them as Mormon wonder underwear. When we first arrived, the people around Main Street were polite yet guarded. But after they found out my husband was the son of the great Lot Smith, who fought the Federals with Brigham Young and founded Tuba City and had 8 wives and 52 children, they warmed right up. As a matter of fact, they started treating us like visiting dignitaries. I had 30 students of all ages, and they were a sweet and well-behaved lot. Because they were polygamists, they were almost all related in one way or another, and talked about their other mothers and double cousins. The girls doted on Rosemary, who was now 6, and little Jim, who was 4, fussing over them, combing their hair, dressing them up, and practicing their mothering skills. The girls were all listed in the Joy Book, meaning they were eligible for marriage and were waiting for their uncle to decide whom they would marry. The houses they lived in, I came to see, were essentially breeding factories, where as many as 7 wives were expected to churn out a baby a year. The way the Mormons saw it, God had populated Earth with beings in His likeness. So if Mormon men were going to follow the path of God, they had to have their own brood of kids to populate their own heavenly world in the hereafter. The girls were raised to be docile and submissive. In the first few months I was there, a couple of my 13-year-old girls simply disappeared, vanishing into their arranged marriages. Rosemary was fascinated by these kids, with all their multitudes of moms, and their dads with all their sets of wives, and she kept asking me to explain it. She was particularly intrigued with the Mormon underwear, and wondered if it really gave the Mormons special powers. "That's what they believe," I told her, "but that doesn't mean it's true." "Then why do they believe it?" "America is a free country," I said. "And that means people are free to believe whatever cockamamie thing they want to believe." "So they don't have to believe it if they don't want to?" Rosemary asked. "No, they don't." "But do they know that?" Smart kid. That, I came to see, was the heart of the matter. You were free to choose enslavement, but the choice was a free one only if you knew what your alternatives were. I began to think of it as my job to make sure the girls I was teaching learned that there was a big world out there, and there were other things they could do besides being brood mares dressed in feed sacks. In class, I spent the bulk of my time on the basics of reading and writing and arithmetic, but I also peppered my lessons with talk of nursing and teaching, the opportunities in big cities, the 21st Amendment, and the doings of Amelia Earhart and Eleanor Roosevelt. I told them how, when I was no older than they were, I was breaking horses. I talked about going to Chicago and learning to fly an airplane. Any of them could do all that, too, I said, as long as they had gumption. Some of them, both boys and girls, looked shocked, but more than a few seemed genuinely intrigued. I hadn't been in Main Street for long when I got a visit from Uncle Eli, the patriarch of the local polygamists. He had a long, graying beard, scraggly eyebrows, and a beak-like nose. His smile was practiced, and his eyes were cold. I gave him a drink of pollywog water, and as we talked, he kept patting my hand and calling me Teacher Lady. Some of the mothers, he said, had told him that their little girls were coming home from school talking about suffragettes and women flying airplanes. What I needed to understand was that he and his people had moved to this area to get away from the rest of the world. And I was bringing that world into their very schoolroom, teaching the children things that their mothers and fathers considered dangerous and even blasphemous. My job, he went on, was to give them just enough arithmetic and reading to manage the household and make their way through the Book of Mormon. Teacher lady, you're not preparing these girls for their lives, he said. You're only upsetting and confusing them. There will be no more talk of worldly ways. Look, uncle, I said, I don't work for you. I work for the state of Arizona. I don't need you telling me my job. My job is to give these kids an education, and part of that is letting them know a little bit about what the world is really like. Uncle's smile never wavered. Rosemary was sitting at the table drawing, and he walked over and stroked her hair. What are you drawing? He asked. That's my mom, riding Red Devil, Rosemary said. It was one of her favorite stories about me, and she was always making drawings of it. She looked up at Uncle Eli. My daddy used to be a Mormon. But he's not any longer? No, he's a rancher. Then he is lost. Oh, Dad never gets lost. And he doesn't even use a compass. He just says Mom made him throw away his Wonder Underwear. Do you wear Wonder Underwear? We call it the temple garment, Uncle said. You'll make some man a fine wife one day. Shall we put you in the joy book? Leave her out of this, I said, and leave her out of that darned book. I'm done talking to you, he said. If you don't obey me, we will all shun you as the devil. The next day, I gave an especially impassioned lesson on political and religious freedom, talking about the totalitarian countries where everyone was forced to believe one thing. In America, by contrast, people were free to think for themselves and follow their hearts when it came to matters of faith. It's like one of the wonderful department stores in Chicago, I said. You can go around trying on different dresses until you find one that suits you. That night when I went to throw out the dishwater, Uncle Eli was standing in the yard, his arms crossed, staring at me. Evening, I said. He didn't reply. He just kept staring at me, like he was giving me the evil eye. The next night, I looked up from fixing dinner, and there he was again, standing framed in the window, staring out from under his unruly eyebrows with the same baleful expression. What's he want, Mommy? Rosemary asked. Oh, he's just hoping I'll have a staring contest with him. The teacherage didn't have curtains, but the next day I sewed together some feed sacks and tacked them over the window. That evening there was a knock at the door. When I opened it, Uncle Eli was standing there. What do you want? I asked. He just stared at me and I closed the door. The knocking started up again, slow and persistent. I went into the room where we slept and loaded my pearl-handled revolver. Uncle Eli was still knocking on the door. I opened it, and as I did, I swung the gun up and across, so by the time he saw me, the gun was pointed dead at him. The last time I pointed the gun had been at that drunken Ash Fork who'd called Helen a dead whore when I wouldn't sell him any hooch. I hadn't fired then, but this time I aimed just to the left of Uncle Eli's face and pulled the trigger. When the shot rang out, Uncle Eli barked in fright and instinctively jerked his hands up. The bullet had whizzed by his ear, but the barrel had been close enough that his face was sprayed with soot. He stared at me, speechless. You come knocking around here again, you better be wearing your Wonder Underwear, I said, because next time I won't aim to miss. 2 days later, the county sheriff showed up at the school. He was an easygoing country fellow with a goiter. Investigating a school marm for shooting at a polygamous elder wasn't something he did every day, and he seemed uncertain how to handle it. We received a complaint, ma'am, alleging that you took a pot shot at one of the townspeople. There was a menacing intruder, and I was defending myself and my children. I'd be happy to stand up in court and explain exactly what happened. The sheriff sighed. Around here, we like people to work out their differences amongst themselves. But if you can't get along with these folks, and there's many that can't, you probably don't belong here. After that, I knew it was only a matter of time. I continued to teach in Main Street, telling those girls what I thought they needed to know about the world, but I stopped getting dinner invitations, and a bunch of the parents took their kids out of the school. In the spring, I got a letter from the Mojave County Superintendent saying that he didn't think it would be a good idea for me to continue teaching in Main Street come next fall. I was unemployed again, which really fried my bacon because I'd been acting in the best interests of my students. Fortunately, that summer, a teaching job opened up in Peach Springs, a tiny town on a Hualapai reservation, about 65 miles from the ranch. It paid $50 a month, but in addition, the county had set aside $10 a month for a part-time janitor, $10 a month for a bus driver, and another $10 a month for someone to cook lunch for the kids. I said I'd do everything, which meant $80 a month, and would be able to sock away almost all of it. The old school bus had died, so the county had also budgeted money to buy another one, or at least some form of transportation. And after scouting around, I found the perfect vehicle at a used car lot in Kingman, a terrifically elegant dark blue hearse. Since it had only front seats, you could jam a whole passel of kids in the back. I took some silver paint and, in big block letters, wrote school bus on both sides. Despite my fancy silver sign, people in those parts, including my husband, were pretty literal-minded, and they all kept calling it the hearse. "It's not a hearse," I told Jim. "It's a school bus." "Painting the word dog on the side of a pig don't make the pig a dog," he said. He had a point, and after a while, I started calling it the hearse, too. I'd get up around 4 in the morning and cover upward of 200 miles a day between traveling to and from Peach Springs and picking up and dropping off the kids at different stops all over the district. I'd teach the whole bunch by myself, take them all home, return to the school and do the janitoring, then head back to the ranch. I farmed out the cooking at $5 a week to our neighbor, Mrs. Hutter, who made pots of stew that I took to the school. Those were some long days, but I loved the work, and the money started piling up pretty quickly. Rosemary was 7 by then, and little Jim was 5, so I took them with me in the morning, and they became part of the class. Rosemary hated being taught by her mother, particularly because I sometimes gave her paddlings in front of the other students to set an example and show I wasn't playing favorites. Little Jim had also become a handful, and he got his share of paddlings as well, though a spanking never kept either of those rascals out of mischief for long. I had to make 2 trips to collect all the kids, and I left Rosemary, Little Jim, and the kids from the town of Yampai at the school while I made my usual second run to pick up kids from Pika. One morning, when I got back to the school, Little Jim was lying on his back on my desk, stone-cold unconscious. The other kids explained that he'd fallen out of the swing, trying to make it all the way to heaven like the little ghost boy. I was in a bind. I needed to take Little Jim to the hospital, but the nearest one was in Kingman, 35 miles away, and I couldn't leave the kids unsupervised for that long. I packed as many of them as I possibly could into the hearse and had the rest stand on the sideboards, hanging on through the open windows. With Rosemary holding limp Little Jim in her lap beside me, I set out to take all the kids home, going to Yampai, then Pika, the kids on the sideboards having the time of their lives, hooting and hollering, treating it like a carnival ride, before heading to Kingman.